So we end every podcast the same way. We have folks have come on who tell wild stories, you know, funny stories, poignant stories, but we always ask our guests to have their come with their best war story, their story that they would tell at a bar, you know, at a CLE break or whatever it is to a bunch of other lawyers. Kenny Berger, owner of the law office of Kenny Berger. What's your best
on your birthday?
On your birthday.
On your birthday. Man, best war story. You know, it's funny. So I started my own practice when I was 28, about to turn 29. I guess we actually opened the doors when I was 29, and immediately getting thrown in to the fire even before then, and then really being in the fire. And again, we'd work with other law firms mm-hmm. on various cases and still do that. But a lot of times the lawyers that we were dealing with on the other side of cases were 15 and 20 and 30 years older. And I think my favorite war story, we had this case and it was actually up in North Carolina. And what happened was there was a psychiatrist who'd been in South Carolina, had a patient in South Carolina, and the patient was a younger female patient who suffered from schizophrenia. And the psychiatrist who began treating her identified that she had boundary issues, that she had trouble with men who could potentially exploit her and misplace trust. And then he systematically exploited all those vulnerabilities and ended up in this situation where he was trading her needed drugs in return for a personal relationship. And then he began writing her prescriptions for Adderall and other ADD drugs that you don't give someone with schizophrenia because you don't want to hype them up anymore.
Sure.
He was writing her those prescriptions in South Carolina and North Carolina so that she could then bring the drugs back to him at his house. And when she first reported all this to the police, because there was a physical incident. She first reported it to the police. They were like, yeah, right. I mean, they were familiar with her. I mean, mm-hmm. she told them her dad was the Antichrist at one point. She'd contact the cops numerous occasions. And so when she calls and says her psychiatrist is in essence abusing her, they were like, right, how about describe his living room for us? And she describes it. Describe his bedroom for us. She's like, oh, not only can I describe his bedroom, I'll describe his bathroom for you. Here's the tub that we get into. And so the cops end up going over to the house. And sure enough, it matches pillowcase for pillowcase, throw blanket for throw blanket, what she said it would be. And he ends up getting called up to the medical board. And this hospital where he was working, you know, they're, of course, informed on it. And they still sent him, after getting informed and knowing that all this appeared to be legit, they still sent him to the American Psychiatric Association annual conference in San Diego about 2 months later. Ultimately, he ends up having his license suspended and he's no longer allowed to practice in North Carolina. So he came down to South Carolina and was practicing. So that's kind of the backstory. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward a couple years later, we're in litigation. And there's a non-lawyer who works with me who runs the operational sites, the operational chief at my office. He does all the things that allow me to actually be a lawyer. So anytime someone's got...
He's the business guy.
He's the business guy.
Right.
So I'm a okay business guy, but I really enjoy being a lawyer and...
Oh, I hear you.
And doing that side of it. So we complement each other well. And so our chief operating officer is a guy named Jason Savage. And so Jason used to go with me this early on. He'd go with me to certain big depositions and hearings, and he'd go watch trials. And I always wanted that non-lawyer's perspective. And then I saw that, heck, probably the most successful lawyer in America under the age of 50, this guy named Nick Rowley out in California, who's just a beast of a lawyer, amazing lawyer. Anything that you can watch or read that Nick Rowley's done, do it. I found out that Nick Rowley had this non-lawyer, this guy named Steve Haltman, go with him all these different places. I was like, man, I knew I was onto something there. And so Jason would go with me to these depositions and so forth. So I'm deposing the guy who was in charge of like five of these local regional hospitals as part of this much larger hospital group. And we're going to depose him. And right before the deposition, it was up in North Carolina, before the deposition, I'd walked out to use the restroom or something. I come back in this room with this hospital CEO who I'm getting ready to depose and a couple of defense lawyers and this risk manager And the court reporter and my buddy, all of a sudden the room's like gone from being that artificial, just fake, kind of everyone get along before deposition. All of a sudden things are like really tense.
Right.
So I walk in, I'm trying to figure out
what that's what it's like when Joseph was.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out what happened. I mean, I'd only been gone for a minute. And I come back, and again, everything's like real tense. And this guy's, the CEO guy's like very guarded. I started taking his deposition, and he was terrible. I mean, I was, you know, the guy was testifying that, you know, he thought this psychiatrist was a good hire and was well qualified. And so not for golden rule purposes, but just for issues of bias. And I was like, hey, you know, you mentioned earlier that you had a wife and a couple kids. You know, how old are your kids? And my kids are this age. All right, great. And you said, you know, you thought this doctor was well qualified, was a good hire, right? Right. Well, if you really feel that way, would you let your girls treat with them? And he was like, well, I don't think I'd have any problem with that. And I was like, oh, really? I was like, well, you know, which, and so it kind of went from there, and you could just tell the guy was full of it. And he starts talking about how he'd have no problem having his daughters treat with the psychiatrist who sexually exploited his young female patient. And the case ended up settling shortly after that. But anyways, the reason I bring this up, and I get done and we're walking back to my car, and I'm telling my buddy Jason, I'm like, man, that went pretty well. I was like, what was up with that dude? I was like, he seemed kind of scared. He was like, yeah, man, I wanted to talk to you about that. But before I tell you, you got to kind of promise that you won't fire me. And I was like, yeah, man, I mean, we've been friends for a long time. I don't plan on firing you. What happened? He was like, well, you know, when you got up to use the restroom, everyone was kind of, you know, just talking, shooting the breeze. And that hospital CEO guy was like, well, who are you with? And I was like, you know, I'm with Kenny Berger. And the hospital CEO guy was like, I'm sorry to hear that. You know, so I kind of popped him in his chest a little bit and put my finger pretty deep into him and backed him up. And I said, not hardly, brother, not hardly. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. And so my buddy was like, I'm not fired for kind of, you know, poking the guy in the chest and laying hands on before the deposition. I was like, nah, I think it totally threw him off his game.
Deposition went great. It worked.
So to add on top of that,
I think the lesson is you got to have an enforcer.
That's right. You need muscle.
Yeah, you got to bring in the heavy.
Right. Sure. Sure.
So he then says, well, I didn't think that was any worse than you asking the lead defense attorney on the other side, who was an attractive female lawyer, where she was staying during the 2-week trial so that you could make sure you had the room next door to her. And I was like, man, I was just trying to throw her off her game too.
We'll start with you, Nick. If you have a war story from your time, either private practice, working for the government. I see LaRon came in with notes. So he's the only guest to ever come in with notes. I hope everybody heard a page turn on the podcast, because LaRon Washington of the Attorney General. See, that's the excellence that the Attorney General's office has. Always where you prepared. Came in prepared. That's Go ahead, Boy Scout. Nick, we'll start with you. Give LaRon some time to read his notes.
That's right. It's 4-page letter.
Best war story.
Man, best war story. I always will remember when I was a prosecutor. Again, if nothing else, I cannot stress, you always got to be prepared for the unexpected. We're, you know, getting ready for a trial. I won't say the people involved because, you know, we've kind of kept it with us. So I'll keep the names withheld. But, you know, you got to be witnesses and stuff right before the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So we're out in the country going, I think in Monk's Corner. And we're looking, it was a murder. And so we were going to where part of a car crash happened. And we're out in these backwoods. And you just kind of know sometimes when you're in a situation where something is about to not go well.
Right.
You still, you know.
Like me before this podcast.
Exactly. And we're, you know, driving, me, the other attorney, and the investigator. We're down this dirt road in the mud. And we get stuck.
Oh, lovely.
No signal on our phones. So we're having to walk back.
It's a horror movie, basically.
Well, yeah. And we're walking back, you know, to the house where our witness is at. And I'm just looking. There's like water right on each side of us. I'm just waiting for like a dead body to float up.
Sure.
Seriously. Thankfully, when we go to find our the witness, because again, we had no service. We had to walk over to their house. By the grace of God, they had a tow truck business. So they were to get our car out.
Yeah.
Wow. And then we actually did an interview, though.
that was a very interesting day. And then we went home and
that's
had a car that never happened.
Never to speak about again. Kenny, what about you?
When I first started practicing, I was fortunate enough to be able to cut my teeth on some plaintiff's work, the Graniteville train derailment. And we had taken a lot of the opt-outs. It was a class action. These people had opted out of the class. And so we had 100-some-odd plaintiffs. And my mentor and one of my favorite people on this entire planet, Cheryl Schaun, who is still at the old firm, she brought me up. Mm-hmm. And she prepped me for this mediation. I go to this meeting. And it was very contentious because it was regular blue-collar folks against the train company.
Okay.
And the train company was just, no pun intended, trying to run everybody over.
Right.
And they had the money. They had, you know. And so the guy I was representing, he was handling the estate of his mother who had passed. And it was his contention and our contention that the chlorine exposure from the train derailment caused her death. And so he was angry at the train people,
right,
to the point where we thought if they're in the same room, something might happen.
Right.
And so we work, and I work my tail off, and we actually settle it for a pretty good number. And I'm talking to him, and you have to have a good bedside manner. And so you really start to feel with these people and feel for these people. And so we made a connection. But at the end of the call, one time I was at home. He calls my cell phone. I don't even remember how he had my cell phone because I don't generally give it out. And so I go into the other room and I'm talking to him. And at the end of the conversation, he goes, "I love you." And I sit there and there's like an awkward 4 or 5 second pause. And I go, "I love you too." And I get off the phone and my wife comes and she goes, "Who are you talking to?" So,
dang, we heard a beginning relationship and the end.
That's right.
That close. What's the, all right.
Kenny, we do family law, by the way.
Yeah. Story short now.
Don't put that on him.
All right. Exactly.
All right, LaRon. Go ahead. Look at your notes.
I'm irresistible, so y'all can say what y'all want to.
There you go.
She outkicked her coverage.
So, now that I think back to it, I think this was actually my very first general sessions trial that made it to verdict.
Okay.
And, as a prosecutor, you kind of get your war stories from the things that happen to you in trial. The bad verdicts, the not guilty verdicts. So we had this one case, it was a drug case, and it was a TIA trial in the guy's absence, so this joker didn't even show up for his own trial. Generally, juries are going to hold that against you, even though, they're not allowed, but there's a human nature element to it, and it's just like, I'm sure there's the vast majority of trials and absences are won by the prosecution. So this was a case where there was a, these folks were selling drugs out of a hotel, and then this guy, who was a co-defendant to the main guy we had on trial, he sells weed from the co-defendant to a guy who was actually an undercover officer.
Okay.
So they catch him, they send it, and they arrest the guy who sells the weed to the co-defendant, and then they send him back in to make a buy from the guy we had on trial. So they go in, he does that, they send him in with documented funds, meaning, they've got the serial numbers of all the bills and stuff that they sent in. Guy goes in, he buys some marijuana from the defendant, gives him the documented funds, the defendant puts it in his pocket, everything like that. So they're like, okay, we're good, we saw it, it was on video, whatever. They go in, exactly. They go in, they arrest this guy. He's got the documented funds in his pocket. He's got a pocket full of weed. They go in, they interview him. They have a recorded confession. Play all of this for the jury. And he, there were some other guys in the room, but, they talk to him about it. They're like, hey, whose drugs are these? And the defendant says, they're mine, all mine. These guys had nothing else to do with it.
Right.
So, the defense attorney at this point, he's in such a bind that his argument is literally, this is too good of a case. ladies and gentlemen of the jury, ask yourself, why is this case so good? And I'm sitting there like, what? What am I missing? Is that a real defense? So long story short, the jury comes back after 2 hours of deliberating, probably even less than that. And they're like, not guilty.
And I'm like, what?
This is my first trial. I'm like, well, you know, I might as well quit now. Yeah, you know, if I can't win this one, right. I can win any of them. So, and the actual, like, the next funny part was the defendant shows up at my office the next day. So he conveniently misses his trial.
Right, but he's showing up
the next day.
Right, for the victory lap. Not guilty. Yeah.
And he's like, hey, man.
He brought you a food basket.
He's like, oh, I was just trying to see if I get my cell phone and my money back. I'm like, what? You don't get out of here? That's ridiculous. So he's rubbing it in. This guy's Teflon, whatever. So
right.
Adair, at the end of every episode, we ask our guests for their favorite war story. Now, this could be from your time as a politician, could be time from practice, anything that you find could be funny, poignant, whatever it is. If we asked you, Direct Examination Podcast, future Congresswoman Adair Burroughs, what's your favorite war story?
Wow. My favorite. The one that comes to mind first is my very first deposition, which was in a shelter case. And the party, the taxpayer, flew to the deposition on his private plane. And I walked into the deposition room and he looked at me and said, hey, what are you, like 12? And that day I determined
when he picked himself off the floor.
We were gonna win. Yeah. And at the end of that case he paid $6 million in taxes.
Wow. And
that's a good one.
That's a good war story. That's a pretty good war story. Brad, so you have the unique distinction, I believe, and I think Dane or Amber correct me, of being the first non-lawyer on our podcast.
Fantastic.
But obviously the amount of time you spend in courtroom and with cops far exceeds what I've done. We certainly think you're qualified. However, we ask all our lawyers at the end of every episode for their favorite war story from practice. Now, you haven't done that, but in your investigation of this particular case, is there a particular story that sticks out, a war story that's either funny or poignant or sad, something that kind of stays with you in talking to all these individuals and doing all this research?
Sure. I mean, there are so many. The ones that I don't tell that often, I'll tell you just because I'm feeling a little bit more open to society now because I don't get to see anybody anymore. So I feel
perfect
a lot more
time. We got our part. Yeah.
Talking about how much of a absolute, you know, terrified human being I was during a lot of this, to where, you know, people were telling me to, you know, watch myself and be careful and everything all the time. Right. And there are two, you know, sort of competing stories that happen here. The first part of me being terrified is that people refused sometimes to talk to me on the phone. They wouldn't exchange emails with me. They only wanted in-person meetings. There was one day a man said, yes, I will meet with you. And we met at this park pavilion. I always try to get there before them so I could see them walking in, try to get a look on them. Guy walks up and he looks at me and he goes, turn off your phone. And I said, okay. And he made me show him me turning my phone off and putting it face down on the table. And then he burst into tears. And he says, you have to stop doing what you're doing. Somebody's going to get hurt and it's probably going to be you. And that's how I first started meeting with this guy. We talked for 2.5 hours after that. Ultimately, I was never hurt, but that's the kind of thing that I was hearing from people, right? So this kind of thing happened a lot. I was also dealing with somebody else who I never publicly identified, and I still can't, but a man who was talking to me off the record. And two things happened with this man, and I had spoken to this man before I spoke to the other guy, where I went, and he scared me. He was a guy that he had killed somebody in the past, and he was associated with a lot of the Dixie Mafia guys back then. And so when I went in, I wasn't sure how it was going to go. So I put my phone in my pocket and I turned it on to record. Now, it was never any sound that I was going to use. I just wanted, since I wasn't going to be able to take notes, I wanted a record of what was happening. So I threw my phone on record in my pocket. And we talked for about 1.5 hours before I finally got around to asking him about Frank Looper. And he looked up at me and he says, give me your phone right now. And I realize, I mean, if you've got an iPhone, you know, at the very top of that, there's a little red bar. If you're recording, it says you're recording. And I didn't know what to do at the time because the man is straight out of Central Casting. I mean, it's, you know, you look at a Hollywood Dixie Mafia killer. That's exactly what he looks like. And I'm in my pocket and I've got a jacket on, and I thumb and I hold it just tight enough, and it turns off before I pull it out and hand it to him. So that's that part of that story. But the story continues because several months later, I'm staying at an Airbnb because we're having our house worked on and my family's out of town. And the same guy calls me up at about 8 o'clock one night, and he says, "I need you to come to my house right now." And I'm like, "I'm not sure that's a great idea. Can we meet tomorrow?" He goes, "No, it has to be right now." And I waited. And I think if I were to make that decision today, I'd probably make a much different decision. But that night I didn't have anybody around me. My wife and kids weren't there. And so I wasn't thinking as smart as I probably should have. So I went and I pull up, and the first thing he does is says, "Pull your truck all the way up, behind this locked gate." And I refused to do that. I said, "No, my truck's going to stay right here." But we went back behind his locked gate and we sat outside, and we sit there and we are in almost complete darkness. There's a street light, close enough that it's like lighting our faces just a little bit, but that's it. And we sit there, and the man's smoking cigarette after cigarette, and we're talking, and I'm freezing. It's a cold April night. And all of a sudden I feel this movement right behind me, right over my shoulder. And I just tense up, and I'm like, "This is it. This is where it ends right here. This is the moment. Oh, they're going to get me right now." And then it just comes at me. Boom. And it's a stray cat that's just jumped off a truck and just landed like right beside me.
Come out of your skin.
I mean, I come from a family that has heart problems to begin with. And I thought,
oh God,
if they didn't shoot me in the back of the head, it was going to be a heart attack from a cat.
That's how you go. That's what ends up getting you.
What happened to Brad? It was a cat. So those are a couple of little war stories.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Those are my God. Outstanding war stories.
Dean Hubbard, one thing we asked all of our guests, I think a season ago, and we've switched as we have gone along, is war stories. And because you are a dean, you did private practice, and now you're running our flagship law school, we'll give you two. So what are your best war stories? Anything that stands out to you from your years as a private practitioner and as your time as dean?
Well, there are a lot of stories out there, but I'll just focus on one because I know we're probably out of time. But, well, I can think of 10. I don't know where to get started on this. Let's stick with one, because there was a time about 25 years ago, I was one of the lawyers representing Toyota Motor Sales in disputes against the dealers were suing Toyota over the allocation of cars and whether they were getting cars that could sell or didn't sell. And it was litigation all over the Southeast and from Louisiana down through Florida. And we had one case in Alabama, and Judge Joel Laird, I'll never forget his name, ordered that the CEO of Toyota and the CEO of Southeastern Toyota Distributors come to Anniston, Alabama for a pretrial conference. The Lear jets came into the Anniston airport. I think they had to extend the runway. And they landed at about the same time. And the noses of those two jets touched on the runway. And so the hearing, the courthouse was under renovation. And so they had moved the courthouse to the county jail. So my Japanese client, I picked him up, got in the car, and we started driving to the hearing, and he saw that concertina wire, and he saw guard houses. He said, "I don't know about this American justice system." A pretrial conference said, I had to explain to him it was temporary quarters. We wouldn't be actually in the jail with the people. It was just on the jail property. But that was an experience.
Welcome to America, right?
A little something lost in the translation there. Very little English capability, and I had to really explain he was not going to jail just because he was involved in a civil lawsuit.
one of the things that we're doing as we kind of close out our second season is we interview all of our guests and ask them for their best war stories. So this could be a story that is, you know, if you're sitting at a bar with some friends,
sure.
you're, you know, particularly funny, poignant, had an impact on you, was so ridiculous that you couldn't help but laugh at it. Do you have one of those?
I do. I've got plenty, I'm sure. But one that comes to mind, and I was actually... a criminal colleague, a good friend of mine, his name is Justin Cade. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, I know Justin.
Okay, so him and I were working on a criminal and immigration matter together for a gentleman that was charged with, I want to say, DUI. And it got worked out to a reckless driving, thankfully. And we were doing the plea before the judge. And it's a judge that you get a sense that you don't want to mess around with. You know, you want to get in and get out kind of thing. And we're going through the plea colloquy there, and Justin and I are standing there. He's on one side of the client, I'm on the other side of the client, and the judge is going through the whole process.
His whole feel and stuff,
all yeah. of a sudden, this guy's phone rings, and it's Mariachi El Cucaracha, loud as can be. And the judge just looks at us, just mouth wide open.
Exactly the right song that you want to be
That's
playing.
That's what
right
you
there.
Want to hear, right? Yeah. And I'm thinking, like, where's the salsa? Where's the chips? You know?
Right. All right.
War story.
Right. Yeah, war stories.
Golly. That's hard to pick. Wow.
Look, this is called direct example.
I know.
We asked the hard questions here.
I know. I'm holding my chin, hoping the jury understands. So I got a lot of them, obviously, in football. We want this to be South Carolina related. So yeah, I'll tell them very, very quickly, but two of them was. One of them was, don't overthink yourself, whether you're a college athlete or a trial lawyer or a lawyer in the beginning. But I was trying a case against a very good defense lawyer here in town. And I always had a problem with the jury in the case. It was a doctor who had taken a fall in an apartment complex, and I call it a tiger trap where he fell into. It's bad. My doctor's head's got an injury. Mm-hmm. But I thought not good about the jury the whole time. And the third day, nice trial judge in here in town came in and said, we got a problem. One of the jurors says that they think they know y'all and didn't realize that, and we're sorry about this. I knew it. You know what I'm saying?
You're right.
This defense lawyer who I've known for a long time, I knew he didn't tell me about that. And the judge goes to this other lawyer. She is the mother of your permanent longtime babysitter. Yeah. And this lawyer's face got white. I had no idea, Your Honor. Of course, I'm not believing right. anything about it. Mm-hmm. Judge, I want to mistrial you. You get dramatic. And so it's like, I can't believe this, Your Honor. And he says, what do y'all want me to do? To this trial judge's credit, he was very calm. I said, Judge, at least call her out here and let me speak to this juror, whether it affects her or not. So he calls her out. She's scared to death. It's a grown woman. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a grown woman. Just me and the lawyer in there and the judge in the courtroom, nobody else. And he says, ma'am, it's come to our attention that you realize that you had some knowledge of the party. Actually, I told the story a little bit wrong. The lawyer tells me in that time that he raises it, that he thinks that that woman is the longtime permanent lawyer. So she comes out and says, do you know either of these lawyers? She starts to tear up. She says, Your Honor, I'm so sorry. Mr. Ellis dated my roommate in college. All of a sudden, I had this flash of name this woman and who this roommate was, what I had done, what I'd been with.
Yeah.
So you asked for that process. She never knew that that was her daughter's who she permanently babysat for.
You're like, well, no idea.
Yeah. It was on me the entire time.
How did that relationship
permanently going, what happened to that? I was like, Your Honor, please strike this woman. I have no idea.
So,
always be careful what you ask for as well. That's one of my favorite lawyer stories and war stories because, we overthink ourselves sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Be prepared for the unexpected.
That's right.
You know, usually when people ask about war stories, you never
ever say them to a microphone. Right?
Sure, yeah.
You
sure.
never say that. But
we should call them all Bob.
They're just yeah. these are just good stories.
Good stories. You know, they're all with an asterisk. I mean, of course. You know, yeah.
Well, I was thinking about that when Dennison emailed me, and I was, you know, every day in magistrate court is something new, something different, something unique, because people come there with problems that need to be solved, and they're good people, and they just need an answer to their question a lot of times, and it's always interesting. But the one unique thing about being a magistrate judge is that magistrates set 99% of bonds. So you deal with bond court, and that also means you're not just in jails, but you're in the Department of Corrections. You have to set bonds on prisoners. So about every other month, I have to go out to the Department of Corrections out in Broad River. I know, Dane, you go to all these different prisons, and
everyone knows.
Dane wants to talk on some bonds.
I forgot to check in Lexington this afternoon. Oh, God.
It'll never happen again. You'll make it up for it, I promise.
Dane and his bonds. I'm sure you could go. I bet you got plenty of war stories there. But so when you go out to the Department of Corrections to set bond, there are about three levels of security for dealing with the inmates. You have the low, middle, and then high security. And so you would think that it would be the high would be making the most nervous, and then it would go down. But the high security, you're in death row. You go into Kirkland. You got to go through two things of security. It's like an international flight. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through they buzz you in. You go through a gate. They let you out. The inmate, they do three at a time behind the closed locked doors. And, you know, they're in there for very, very serious stuff.
Right.
But that's fine because they're locked away. And if anything were to happen, which has happened before, you know that the worst would be they might spit through the metal door, and so that can make you nervous. But then as you go down, you have the medium security, which is you're in a kind of like an auditorium room, and it's two guards to an inmate. They have their ankles locked, they have their hands locked to their waist, and they're on actual leash. And so that makes you kind of nervous, but you know that you can probably run a little bit.
There's folks there, yeah.
Yeah, there's stuff going on. But then you go to the low security, and they're just sitting there with one security guard, you know, one officer. And they might be handcuffed. No, they're not handcuffed. They're just sitting across the table from you.
Right.
And so you gotta, you know, they can make you a little nervous if you're, if you're not Dane. Dane's used to this.
Right.
I'm in a room, it doesn't matter what security level, they send me right into harm's way.
The thing is, though,
they're not handcuffed.
You're supposed to be on their side. Sometimes they don't like the judge.
Yeah.
Especially when you're
sitting. They may have different ideas about you versus.
Especially if I set, a tough bond or one they don't appreciate. But normally, with the lower security, it's because they're about to get out. So they only have a few more months left, or it's nothing. And they caught a charge in there, or they had some old warrants for shopliftings. And so they're just ready to get out. They don't want to do anything to mess up their release date, which is right around the corner. But every now and then you'll have some folks who are looking at 30, 40 life in prison. So I had one the other day, other month, and he was in there for murder. And it was just me, the clerk, him, an officer, and it, you know, makes you kind of nervous because they have what do they have to lose? Not much. But so he was friendly. I set a bond. Nothing. It was all fine. And they just bring over, you know, about a dozen inmates at a time, and they just come in one at a time to this little room with no exit. And so after about halfway through of set bonds, I had to use the restroom. So I walk out there, and then all 12 or so, including the guy of murder who I just set his bond, are just sitting out there, and they're right outside the bathroom door. And I kind of look around. I say, anybody seen the restroom? And they point. It's right across the hall. I say, thanks. And so I walk in, and they're all just sitting there. The officer just, you know, right down the hall. It's nothing.
Right.
So I'm sitting there pretty nervous. And I'm trying. And all I can think is that this is, if something were to happen, this is where I'm going to get
killed.
But then I had two thoughts go through my head. I say, well, if something does happen, and, you know, this is my last day, they'll at least name a courthouse or a courtroom after me.
That's
you
true.
Know?
That's true.
But then I think they'll probably just name this bathroom after me. And then I'm just picturing my family coming and laying a wreath outside the door. And I'm thinking, this is not going
to
be good.
After getting strip-searched.
Yeah, that's not the way to go.
So luckily, I nothing happened. The guys were nice, and they didn't kill me that day. And I set the rest of the bond.